The House Committee on Education will come back to order. And I would like to open a work session on House Bill 3688. Colleagues, we are still waiting for the Dash 5 amendment, which is on its way, and it will make the effective date of this bill July 1st of 2010 to ensure that there are no disruptions to this school year. What this bill is doing, I think that these amendments accomplish what we've been talking about for the last two hearings that we've had here. It does not disrupt or change the ability of a public charter school or a typical public school to enter into any sort of contractual partnership with another entity. What this simply says is that the original piece that we talked about, that there would be no incentive payment for someone to attend a school. It also ensures that no parent would ever be required to essentially front the money for a student to receive public education services. I think many of you have received the emails that I have received over the last couple of days that have described a situation where the educational services that the families are receiving, they're very, very pleased with them. But I think the way that that is structured, and I won't cast for good or for ill the intent of why it's structured that way, but the way that it's working is that a student enrolls in a public charter school. Then the student goes to get some or a significant part of their educational services through a third-party entity. Instead of the charter school contracting directly with that third-party entity, the family writes a check to that third-party entity. The family is reimbursed only upon the completion of that term of that class. In public school, in public education, students have the ability to transfer or withdraw from school at any time without a financial penalty. And if the consequence of withdrawing from school is that you aren't reimbursed $500 that you put up, that actually is a financial disincentive if your family needs to move or if you need to enroll. The other problem is that not all people would be able to access this model, because if you don't have the $500 in your checking account that you can afford to have out of your checking account for the course of the term, you aren't going to be able to access those services in the same way the other students, all students that are enrolled in that public charter school. If we pass this amendment in this bill, as it relates to the issue that we've all heard from families about over the last several days, what would happen is that families would no longer be required to open up their checkbook and pay in advance for public education services in the hope that they would eventually be reimbursed. The payment would take place between the public charter school and the third-party entity, and the risk of the student transferring or moving is borne by the public charter school or the third party, dependent on how they arrange their contract, which is the way that it happens in almost every other case that I'm aware of or have heard of. For example, if a student goes to a community college as part of their public school or charter school experience, the payment for tuition is made from the charter school or the public school directly to the community college, not the other way around. Representative Huffman.
So, Madam Chair, the students and the parents would not be risking losing that educational opportunity, but we would be working within the law to make the transfer of monies in a different way and legal so that they could still maintain that educational opportunity?
Representative Huffman, yes. And we have folks here that, attorneys that will talk us through that.
Thank you.
Welcome. Any other questions before? Representative Roblin.
And it would apply to all schools, not just charter schools, correct?
This applies to all schools, not just charter schools. Representative Van Orman.
So the risk is not to the families, the risk is generally, by this bill, the risk would be to the schools.
Correct, which is the way that it is, whether you're a charter school or a public school, we reimburse on an average daily membership because we know that for whatever reason, students move in midterm. It's not always cleanly at a break in school. Okay. Further questions? All right, with that, I would invite up, let's start with Karn Hikus and Rosalind Newhouse.
Good Commissioner Gelser, members of the committee, I was not planning to speak today because I didn't think there would be an opportunity to, but I did want to weigh in. We certainly would support our understanding of the Dash 5 amendments, but I do want to express concern for the way this has all kind of transpired, if you will. Because in the fall, there was a testimony in front of the online task force that there was a charter school.
Ms. Hikes, could you state your name for the record?
Karen Hikes, Northwest Center for Educational Options. We had heard a rumor there was a school giving parents cash incentives for enrolling their children, like a signing bonus. And to my knowledge, that has yet to be substantiated. And in my view, tuition reimbursement does not constitute cash incentive for enrolling and a signing bonus. So I feel like there's been a lot of things kind of mischaracterized and misconstrued throughout this process, and with charter schools kind of at the top of the list, and just need to kind of express concern about that, if you will. I think that if you adopt this and you allow a charter school or any other school to pay tuition to another school, I'm not sure that changes or disincentivizes a family any more than if you were to give the funds directly to a parent. I mean, I'm fine with not giving funds directly to a parent. I think that makes perfect sense. But I'm not sure it changes whether the parent is inclined to enroll their kid in that particular school. And I know that the schools that are involved in this don't want to create a big hoopla. And so I think that the schools that have been doing this are actually going to stop doing this at the end of the school year. They won't be doing it anymore because it's kind of not worth the collateral damage and having charter schools drug through the mud. So just so you know that, this isn't going to continue anymore in the format that you've heard about. And I welcome any questions.
Are there any questions for Ms. Hikes?
I have one.
Thank you.
So you've indicated there is a specific school, as we've gone through this process, or a significant...
Well, only the one the ODE referenced on Monday during the hearing.
Correct.
Yes.
Are you aware, or does your organization have a position on all of the issues that have been raised about the All Prep Academy in the letter that has gone out from ODE to all of the school districts that are contracting with them? Are you providing any technical assistance to help them come into compliance with the law in terms of enrollment, financial practices, and other concerns raised by the department about being outside the bounds, not of law that we're setting now, but existing law?
Right. So what I know is I've seen the letters and I've talked with all the folks involved with the Department of Education and with the All Prep folks, and there are a lot of allegations made in the letter. I think only one of them is substantiated, and that was substantiated after the letter was written. So my understanding is there's actually not a lot of illegal activity going on, but there are a lot of concerns because there's a lot of misunderstanding and a lack of clarity around the school, around how the schools are doing some of their practices. So we're working with them in the sense that we're providing coaching on how to be more clear and not walk the line, if you will, but be err on the side of caution. Okay. In some of the practices, instead of kind of skating on thin ice, if you will, and being very explicit with the practices and how they comply with law and more communicative with districts and with community members. I haven't seen that there's egregious violations of law happening. I think that there were some students transferred overnight in an attempt to appease a district board that was sponsoring that school. And in the end, that turned out to be, you know, obviously that was the wrong thing to do, to transfer students without parental permission. So that's the one thing I know that has gone on that is being corrected. The other things, I'm not aware that they're actually happening.
And then are you aware, I saw a news article in the Register Guard that indicated the Marcola School District was meeting an executive session to review their contract with All Prep Academy. Sisters School District recently terminated their charter with the All Prep Academy because of their concerns about the legality of their practices. Do you know what decision Marcola made, or if there are any other schools that
I only know based on the article as well, Rep. Gelser, I don't know what, I mean, that's where I learned about it as well. Yeah.
But as far as this Dash 5 amendment goes, your organization is comfortable with
sure.
this.
Sure.
Are there any other questions? Representative Parker.
Thanks, Madam Chair. You referenced conversations or your concerns that this practice would cease to exist if we pass this bill. It would be too much for the schools to go through and that it would just stop. I'm curious as to, I don't think in the Dash 5 amendments that we're looking at, that there is that much of a change as we understand them. And so I'm curious as to what you base that upon. Is it actually conversations with one or more of the schools?
Yes.
And is it due to a cash flow problem that would be induced by this, or what would the rationale be?
Well, the dollar transactions would be the same. So
mm-hmm.
if the school was to continue this, and
the timing would be
up
different.
To $500 per term or whatever it is, the dollar amounts wouldn't change. It would just be a matter of whether the dollars went to the program or to the parents. I think the reason they would cease is because they don't want to be drug into a big political issue.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
this was something that they were trying to do to help families and help kids. They didn't think it would create any problems. And the fact that it is creating problems, they don't want to do that. Does that make sense? And yes, what I'm saying is based on the conversation that I had this morning with the director of the All Prep Schools.
Thank you.
So it sounds like the director of the All Prep School is saying that they will no longer be reimbursing parents for participation at the Village Home?
Correct. And they will probably no longer be reimbursing Village Home either for courses taken there by parents.
And that's a choice that All Prep is making on its own?
Right, because of all of these conversations. Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Karen, what we're doing today wouldn't alleviate that concern so that they could continue seamlessly providing that. I mean, I came here today with that being my intent. I'll just say that on the record, to try to create the legal climate where they could continue, just write a check to a different entity instead of a person, maybe. I mean, what you're saying, I hate to hear that we may not succeed in that today because of a fear on All Prep's part.
Well, I think the issue is whether or not it's appropriate for dollars to go to a private entity that's not a registered school in any way. It's not a registered alternative school. It's not a registered private school. It's basically a private tuition-based program. And it sounds like a great program. I'm actually not that familiar with the program, but everything I hear tells me it sounds like a great program. But I'm not sure that funneling private funds to that type of model is something that either the legislature or the Department of Education is going to continue to allow to happen long term. So I think they're kind of thinking we either stop this ourselves or we're eventually going to be stopped. And we might as well stop ourselves now.
Representative Huffman.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Is Cindy or somebody going to be able to come up and address that specific question about whether that specific relationship between All Prep and Village Home would be allowed to continue?
Yes, I have Cindy and Morgan on the list. I was going to call them last so they could address any questions that arose through the other panels.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Just a quick clarification. I was trying to listen real closely, but did you say private money going to private schools? I thought did you mean public money?
Public money. Public money going to private schools.
Okay. Are we digging into private to private? Okay. Got it. Thank you.
Sorry about that.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Well, I think it's fair to say that if you're not familiar with taking care of the public's money, it's an extraordinarily new experience. And when I saw some of this, and especially in the letters that I received, for me, it did indicate some naivete about how you handle money when it's the public's money. And so I looked at it as, you know, a learning curve.
Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Karen, just I would really ask for the support of your organization in helping with the messaging on this, because I'm concerned that the way this will be presented is that because that this committee is taking action, and ultimately the legislature will pass a bill whose effect will be to shut this school down, in a sense, or at least to shut this program down. And my understanding is that your sense is that is not what is happening, right? That this amendment, this bill as amended, does not affect their plan, but rather it's sort of perhaps the heightened scrutiny of their operation that is causing them to be to perhaps pull back from it?
I would not say they're concerned about scrutiny. They're concerned about politics, and they're concerned about, you know, focusing in on serving their kids and not kind of being derailed by a very tiny program serving a very tiny number of kids and kind of creating this higher profile conversation about it. They were just trying to serve kids. That's my understanding. It's not about scrutiny or fear of that. It's about just the politics of it and, you know, the backdrop of it, if you will.
Yeah, follow up.
So
what exactly do you mean by the politics of it? Do you think that, I mean, what would they be afraid of exactly, do you think?
Well, I think the characterization of tuition reimbursement as cash incentives for parents to enroll in the kid, that's one major piece of it. I think they take issue with that, and I do too.
Can you see, though, how a school making a payment directly to a family could easily be misperceived as a cash payment or a cash incentive? Might that not be a reason to ensure that we don't have, whether they are public schools or charter schools, in the position of holding on to money that a family may or may not have dependent on whether or not they remain enrolled in a school for a period of time?
Mm-hmm. I think that this whole practice is something that shouldn't happen. And that's been my advice since I became aware of it in December.
Can I ask you one other question?
Sure.
These are questions I didn't have yesterday. I received many, many emails, as did the rest of you, had some good conversations with people online. One of the questions that I asked of, the first thing was, I was surprised because the discussion we had on Monday was, okay, this may have happened one time in one place. I think what we learned were dozens and dozens of families for whom this practice is currently happening to. So we've answered that question about whether that was an isolated thing that happened one time or whether it's a common practice for this organization. But I asked some of the families, what do you get from Village Home, and what is it that you get from All Prep? And the response that I tended to get was, I get up to $500 reimbursement for the classes that I take at All Prep, which weren't things like, they were core classes like math and science and social studies, and that All Prep purchased for them the Calvert curriculum, which I looked up, it's $800 on the market if you go and buy it. That's what the internet catalog that I found said. So that's $1,300. They weren't aware of other services that All Prep provided to them. What happens to the rest of that ADM? What exactly is it that All Prep Charter School provides beyond that, beyond giving a packaged homeschool curriculum and reimbursement for educational services provided by a private entity? And if there isn't anything else, do you think that that is an appropriate use of charter school law to create an entity that signs up people so that if I sign up with you, I get my homeschool materials paid? Isn't that just essentially a charter shell that is using public monies for private vouchers?
Prep Gelser, I would say that I do not work for All Prep, and I don't know the inner workings of, I don't know if those students are half-time or full-time in All Prep. I don't know.
Who doesn't?
Yeah, the All Prep staff would know. So, I mean, we would need to bring in, you know, one of the administrators from All Prep to have that detailed level of conversation.
And
I'm not sure.
I guess just as a follow-up, this is the place where Representative Dimbo and the question of what is the intent or the expectation moving forward. I think that there are a lot of places where it makes sense for a public school or a public charter school to partner with a private nonprofit partner to supplement the education that is provided by them. I am trying to figure out, and I guess I want to be clear, personally, I don't know what the rest of the intent is on the committee, but I would hate for this discussion to become an endorsement of the idea of having a charter school that essentially does not provide charter services, but provides vouchers for private school. I don't know that that's what is happening, but based on the letters that I received from families last night, as they described to me the way they understood their program, it sounded a lot like that. Nothing that those families was doing was wrong. I don't want to cast any aspersions on those families, and I'm sure they're the best of intentions from the organization, but it just looks suspiciously in this structure like a charter shell that provides private vouchers if we can't find out what it is that the charter is providing. And would
I know
you agree
we're talking
that
about 100 kids, you know, out of 1,600 or something that the All Prep schools serve. So I do know it's a small number of kids. But, again, I don't know exactly the inner workings. You know, I know they're a hybrid school. I mean, I know certain things about the all-prep model, but I don't know.
Isn't there a similar relationship with the Home Source program in Lane County as well, though? Isn't this replicated in other parts of the state just with different partner agencies?
Similar, except Bethel Home Source is a registered alternative school with the Department of Education, and they contract with districts for. So it's kind of, and I thought that Village Home was a registered alternative school. That's what I was told.
Okay. Less than an hour.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think we're, like, really, you know, sidetracked onto an old dirt road that we can't even find the edge yet. Let's get back to the core of this conversation. The core is we found a loophole in the law that you could drive a school bus through. You can pay kids to do whatever. And that the conversation we've had on this committee, regardless of how it all started, was we don't want direct compensation to families to incentivize them to come to program. And I think there's total agreement on that point. Then, but beyond that, we said, well, you know, there are other things that could not be considered compensatory, but are as an adjunct to a program, such as the internet, a computer that's required for homes or for online. And maybe some other services. And let's focus back on what that is. Let's try to close the door a little bit, and that other stuff, I think, is really not where we're going to go, because I think that's more, that program's an anomaly as opposed to what's happening around the rest of the state. And let's focus on the big issue, and if we have to come back to address somebody that's trying to skirt that, then let's address it now. But
And I think that's an appropriate. I think that's an appropriate point. I do think it's important to get some of those pieces on the record, to in the effort to preserve the experience these families are having, if it is appropriate. Mm-hmm. I believe it's the intent to do that. I do not believe the intent of this legislation, as we're passing it, is to open some new door or to have the legislature give a head nod to vouchers for private education. And I that's what I want to.
Okay.
To put on the record.
Representative Reblin. Yeah, and I kind of go along a little bit with what Representative Morrison is saying, is that one of the things I would really mention is that if we pass this amendment, we really need to make sure that OSBA gets it out to all of our schools, because I would guarantee you that there are many, many school districts that have tuition reimbursement programs that exist today that say, you bring me back the transcript that you finished the course and your receipt, and we'll reimburse for that class and transcript it into our class. I would say, many regular public schools do that on a regular basis, and if we're going to change that, I want to make sure that gets out to those people, because that is a practice that I don't think is totally uncommon. And we can ask the department, but I think there are school districts out there that are doing that, and as you described this law, and as I look it over, they may no longer be able to do that.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a...
No, go ahead.
The only thing I was going to say to that question, we should invite the school district who agreed to the charter school, because this is not,
right.
A charter school has to work with their school district. Mm-hmm. And if we want to know the answers to the internal questions of a particular charter school, I think we should invite them.
Well, I think we should do that for one of our informational hearings later this month. We can invite Mr. King, and we can invite some of their chartering agencies and have this discussion openly. Okay, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just a great opportunity to set out there. It's not necessarily a counter-argument to what you're talking about there by any means. But as we have this discussion about where the payment goes directly to the schools. And it's just a point that we need to remember as we're talking about this. I don't think it affects the larger policy decision, which is what we need to be talking about here. But when you do have these students that are initially paying for the course, and I'm not necessarily talking about all prep, but when you have a student that initially pays for the course, and we all know this intuitively, when you have some skin in the game, your engagement is much greater than, I don't really need to worry about this anymore. Somebody else is taking care of this. And I think that that's a very important element for us to, I'm not saying this necessarily completely guides our policy decision, but it's a very important element that we need to keep in mind, that when I have that investment, I show up and I think, I want my X amount of dollars worth. I think that's important for us to remember.
Well, thank you, and I'm going to call up our next panel. We need to finish this work session by 2:05. So we still have Roger Williams, Rosalind Newhouse, and Connor Williams. And I would just ask you to be as brief as possible, please. Maybe 3 minutes max.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Rosalind Newhouse. I'm a parent of an all-prep student. I'm also a board member at Village Home Education Resource Center. This is Connor Williamson, who's also a student, an all-prep student, and a board member at Village Home Education Resource Center.
I'm not an all-prep student.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm a student at Village Home,
okay.
And I'm the student representative on the board, okay, of Village Home.
I wanted to address a couple of questions that had been brought up in the last few minutes. We do have a number of all-prep students attending classes at Village Home Education Resource Center. These are public school students. They're registered with all-prep. They take the OAKS standardized testing. In terms of what services they receive through the charter school, it is not simply a reimbursement for Village Home classes. They receive regular visits from their teachers. They do receive the Calvert curriculum or other curriculum as is found appropriate. My daughter, for instance, who's a junior, she's pretty much done with all of the standard Calvert high school curriculum, and she's now taking the early college program through All Prep. She's taking classes at Chemeketa Community College and at PCC, doing remarkably well in all of them. Does remarkably well in her OAKS testing. She meets with her advisor, her All Prep advisor, at least monthly, and emails her regularly, so she's getting pretty constant input and feedback from All Prep as far as her courses, her plans for the future, her college preparation, her PSAT, her SAT lineup. And so this is a considerable investment of All Prep's time into my daughter's education. She would not be happy in a brick-and-mortar school. She doesn't do well in large groups, and she's surpassed that educational level. With All Prep, she can get the courses that she requires. She's taking classes at Village Home as well. She's taking Latin, and she's taking science, and she's taking calculus through Village Home. Those classes would not be available to her in her local public school. As far as the reimbursement, and I understand this is quite a matter for some concern.
And I'm also going to have to ask you to summarize, please.
Yes, please. Okay. When a student, an all-prep student takes classes at Village Home, they are reimbursed by all-prep for their layout. The family doesn't make anything on that. They're reimbursed for exactly what they pay out. If they withdraw from a class, they get their money back and they don't get reimbursed. If they continue with the class or if there are additional charges, All Prep reimburses that up to the $500. No one's making a cent on this, and it's reimbursed only as it's spent. There is some delay in how it's reimbursed. It's not contingent on the student's completion of the class. It simply turns out that the cycle of reimbursement tends to be that the reimbursement is received near the end of the 10-week class term, and so the family lays out the money and is then reimbursed toward the end of the term.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Galston, members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak here today. My name is Connor Williamson. I live here in Salem, Oregon, and as I said before, I'm the student representative on the board of Village Home Education Resource Center. I've taken classes there for the past 4 years. I know that many all-prep families would like to be in attendance today. The short notice has unfortunately precluded this. Most of the families who take both All Prep and Village Home live in the Portland area, so they would have had to make it down here. I know that for many All Prep students, the ability to take classes at Village Home is one of their favorite parts of their education. Many families in the program would otherwise have financial difficulty paying for their children to take classes at Village Home and other private educational institutions. I spoke with one All Prep mother yesterday who was distraught that she would not be able to continue to have her son work in a classroom setting at Village Home because without All Prep's assistance, she would not be able to afford the classes. The blended online model of education is a great fit for many students. I have a lot of friends who do all prep and have spoken with them about their experiences with the program. Depending on the topic, some students work better online, some work better in a classroom. For example, a student might thrive with online math from all prep, yet a classroom environment at Village Home may be superior for learning Shakespeare. Yet with another student, they'd want to take Shakespeare online and math in a classroom. The blended education model allows for both of these students' needs to be accommodated. And finally, Rosalyn already went over this, but it's important to clarify that the All Prep families never have received cash or gift incentives for signing up for the program. It's simply reimbursement. Basically, the families pay for the Village Home classes, and All Prep reimburses them for the cost therein.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Williams.
Representative Gelzer, committee members, thank you. You usually see me here with another hat. I'm here strictly as a private citizen today. I'm not part of the All Prep Village Home ecosystem. I do need to say as I start that I've only heard good things about Village Home. They have, from what I can tell, they have a very high quality.
And Mr. Williams, could you start with your name for
Roger
the record,
Williams.
Please? Thank you.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Having said that, I want to say that I think the committee is going in the right direction on this, and I want to give you my private support.
Thank you very much. Are there any brief questions for this committee? Or panel? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. What difference would it make if you actually gave Village Home the $500 so that the parents and the child could take the courses instead of reimbursement?
Excuse me. There's not a real significant difference in terms of accessibility and availability. The primary issue might be in the logistics of it. It does cost Village Home money to put the classes on, to pay for the teachers, to pay for materials for the classes, and so forth. And if that money's not forthcoming at the beginning of the term, then you know, we may not be able to provide the same level of service.
Well, I have another question, but I'll keep it.
I just have a follow-up to that. Mm-hmm. If the difference, though, was that all prep paid you at the beginning of the term instead of the parent paying you at the beginning of the term, would it have any measurable difference on the experience of the students?
Well, I hesitate to speak unilaterally for the board, but I'm speaking personally. I would say I don't see that it would make a difference.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Gotta do that.
Just very briefly, Rosalind.
Mm-hmm.
So when your daughter, right?
Yes.
Turns in homework and tests,
mm-hmm.
does she do that with All Prep Academy or does she do that with Village Home?
It depends on which class she's taking. When she's doing Latin work, you know, Latin classes, Latin work, she turns in the classes, the material directly to her Latin teacher who is at Village Home. If she's doing a class with PCC, she's turning in the assignments to her PCC instructor. Last year, when she was doing All Prep classes, she was turning in those assignments to the All Prep teacher.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Rosalind, another sort of informational question. And let me say, first of all, that, you know, in all the emails that I received, you know, from the parents who were involved, I heard only very positive things about Village Home, and I'd like to just put that on the record.
Okay.
Your daughter is, you said she's taking classes both at PCC and at Village Home?
Yes.
And is she, I mean, aside from those, how many hours a day would you say she's with All Prep?
Well, since her classes are now, she's not doing the Calvert classes. She finished all those. So now all of her classes are either PCC or Shemeketa or Village Home classes. And altogether, she is probably spending, you know, it varies from week to week depending on the particular workload, but I would say she's probably spending about 30 hours a week on schoolwork and assignments.
That's great. And so you're paying Shemeketa and Village Home for her studies there, except that you're reimbursed $1,500 over a year, right? $500.
Right. The arrangement that ALPREP has with the community college is a direct billing, and so we don't, you know, we register or she registers for the classes, and they bill Shemakita, or I'm sorry, they Shemakita or PCC bills ALPREP for that. But we buy the books and are then reimbursed for the books, the textbooks.
Okay, so yeah. I'm sorry, just to follow up. So ALPREP is paying her tuition, the totality of her tuition at Shemakita,
yes,
and the community college?
Yes. And that's another third-party provider. And I would like to say, too, one of the things that one of our parents emailed to me just this morning was, you know, in terms of the school paying a third-party provider for classes, I think almost every public school in the state is paying third-party providers, mm-hmm. OMSI and Mad Science and, you know, any number of
right.
outside
right.
That's correct. Things coming in.
Yes.
And this bill is not intending to prohibit that from happening for anybody.
Right. Understand.
Representative Comp.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe I just need a tutorial offline, and I apologize. But I'm confused. I thought this was homeschoolers dealing with a private academy, and yet we're talking about the essential services that any public school student is already entitled to by statute. So I'm confused why somebody goes through three different pathways to access what we offer in our public schools.
Thank you for asking that question, because it is a point of confusion for many people. The situation that ALPREP is addressing for students in general, and I believe I'm not with ALPREP, and I can't speak for them, but my understanding as an ALPREP parent of why ALPREP is set up the way it is that they are attempting to address the individual needs of each student according to that student's needs. And so that if that student requires a Latin class that happens to be given by an organization serving a lot of homeschoolers, then that student can go and take the Latin class at Village Home. If that student requires a college course in calculus, that student can go ahead and take a calculus course at a community college. If that student requires to work at home on a computer on a Calvert curriculum, then they'll do that. And because of the way that ALPREP treats each student as a unique individual, I believe that is what allows each of those students to flourish and do well where they might not do well in a traditional setting. As far as Village Home and the homeschool thing, yes, Village Home is primarily an organization of homeschool members. However, Village Home does make classes available to any student regardless of their schooling status, whether they're public, private, homeschool, virtual school, whatever. We don't discriminate.
Thank you. And we're going to go ahead and move on to... Yes, just as a time check for the committee, we still have two more people to hear on this bill, and we have more than 10 people to hear on the next bill.
Thank you, Chair. What my comment would be, and I'm not asking for a response to this, but I'm thinking, okay, I have four daughters. They all took college prep courses in their high school to meet their needs, and I, as a single parent, assisted in paying for their tuition. Why would any of us keep our kids in a public school then? I'm just confused.
I'll agree with your comment.
Thank you, Representative Thatcher.
Mr. Williams, you mentioned that you felt the committee was on the right track, and I just wanted to hone in on what it is you think we're on the right track.
Two things. Don't put parents at risk. This is actually, don't put parents at risk for the money for their education. You need to have accountability for public money. I think that's really important. Some of you, and now I'm going to put on my other hat for a second. We left, we had some homeschool kids come through today, and we left a chart You've seen this chart before, and I'd appreciate it if you keep in mind that private homeschooling does not take public money,
right.
And that's the basis that we come to you. Please keep that distinct from those who do take public money, which I call public school at home people. That's an important distinction to make. Did I answer your question?
Sort of. Well, just, Madam Chair, my, you talked about, well, why doesn't the charter school pay the private provider directly rather than reimbursing the parent? And I'm not seeing how that would be allowed anymore through the language here. And maybe I'm confused, need a tutorial along with Representative Comp here. But it says right in the bill, if I'm looking at the dash fives, mm-hmm. that is the, okay. It says subsection 2 of section 1. It says a provider of educational services may not offer payment of money or other consideration to a student, blah, 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 or to another entity for the benefit of a student. Would that be considered if they made the payment directly to Village Home, as is in this case, a payment to another entity for the benefit of the student?
I think you have to look at the subs underneath that. It's yeah. number one, if that's in return for the student electing to okay. receive or receiving educational services from a specific provider of educational services. So saying, if you go to this one specific place, then we will provide you this reimbursement, or following the student's completion of an educational program, if the provider of educational services used the promise of payment as an incentive for the student to enroll in the program. So that's basically, if it is an incentive to enroll if you pay, and you don't get paid back until you stay through the end. But if it's just part of a contractual relationship that you have, that's not precluded. And we'll have the attorneys okay. come up to talk us through that in a moment.
All righty then. Thank you.
Representative Van Orman, you had one final question?
No, I'm fine. Thanks.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So last we have Morgan Allen and Cindy Hunt. Welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education. And I'll make a few brief comments, and then we'll make ourselves available to answer questions of the committee. I think the first comment is that many of the things that were discussed over the last couple of hearings, like kindergarten tuition, scholarships, computers, internet access, none of that, those types of items would be impacted by this amendment. So all those expanded options programs, community college classes, all that stuff would not be impacted by this amendment. The second question, or the second comment, is based on information that we received from Mr. King, this program would be allowed to be continue. They would still be the All Prep Academy would still be allowed to have students attending Village Home. It's just the nature of the arrangement would need to be a little bit different. Instead of having parents front the tuition money and then get a reimbursement check from the All Prep Academy, this amendment, based on info we got from Mr. King, would likely require that Mr. King's All Prep Academies contract with Village Home and pay them directly. And then and ultimately, I guess the third comment is that we would agree that it's really a question of equity. Is some parents, you know, even if it's only a few hundred dollars, many parents, especially in these tough economic times, are not able to front that money. And these are public charter schools, and they are required to provide a comprehensive education program to their students. And, you know, we don't think that parents should have to front to pay for that. So, and since it came up, the letters that the department has sent to the school districts that have All Prep Academies, I've shared those with this committee. Ms. Sant would be and I would be happy to answer questions about those as well, and we'd be happy to come back to this committee and share our findings. But we do take pretty strong exception to some of the characterizations made about those letters earlier in the hearing, that the issues that we raised were not substantiated. We would not have sent the letters if we didn't believe that there were behaviors that were inappropriate going on at the academies, and specifically the behavior that Ms. Hykus referenced, where she's describing students being transferred between school districts without the knowledge of parents or school districts. That's absolutely illegal. That is not acceptable behavior for charter schools in Oregon. So we'd be happy to address that at the appropriate time.
And I think we will schedule a follow-up informational hearing in the next week or so. Thank you.
So we'd be happy to answer any questions or walk you through the amendment, whatever you'd like.
Are there questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. We had a hearing recently on this concept. Am I correct?
Yes, Monday.
Okay. And what I'm remembering is it was all about essentially bribery, bribing a student or the parent of the student to go choose this particular service in exchange for money. And now it seems like it's shifting over to, well, we don't want to burden the parent with having to front the money for a program, which is simply a reimbursement as far as I can still tell. But anyway, I'm just wondering why is the argument shifting?
So we talked about this a little bit before. The issue is ensuring that these relationships are appropriate. And I think the argument could still be made that there is an incentive, that even though a parent is not profiting, they face financial loss. If they try a program, it's not working, and they leave, they're out the money that they paid, money that they paid after enrolling in a public school. It's not appropriate if your child is enrolled in Jones School in Levittown, I'm making up towns and schools, the school district would never be allowed to say, you have to pay $500 for your child to have their math class. That school is required to provide a comprehensive education to them without, not at cost to the parents. The incentive becomes to stay there in order to receive that payment. I think this issue has continued to uncover issues that are out there. I think it still remains a modest bill that closes those loopholes. As Representative Maurer said, you could drive a school bus through. I think there are important issues that we uncovered, and part of the reason we have the hearing and amendments is to address the issues as our understanding of them shifts with information. Representative Springer.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. And with all due respect, I think I heard Rosalind, if Rosalind, if I'm correct, I don't see her, did she leave, say that they did not have to stay throughout the term to get that reimbursement.
No, they said that the prep class, the other school would reimburse them if they left. They give them the money back.
But the parents don't get them.
No, the parents get the money back.
And that is not the experience of the complaint that some parents have had. They have been told, if you leave, you will no longer be eligible to have that. I mean, that's how part of this came to light, and that's the substantiated allegation that the department brought to us, was that the family was told, no, you can't leave. If you do, you won't get your reimbursement. That's a problem. If it's not happening, then it doesn't cause any harm.
I'd like to clarify.
I'm sorry, you can't from the side aisle. We have crazy rules here.
No, they're not too crazy.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gasol. I do think it's important to look at it that this is perception. When you give money to a parent, it appears that even though it's maybe called reimbursement, it does appear to be a pay. When you go from an entity to another entity, it doesn't have that kind of characterization. It looks like a legitimate trade practice between two different organizations. And so a lot of this is about perception. And when that money is given to a parent, there's a misconception of what this is all about. And I think that the argument about equity is extremely important. And I also think that the easiest way to get out of this is simply go from organization to organization, agency to agency.
Are there any further questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much. So we are in a work session, Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the committee adopt the -5 amendments to House Bill 3688, dated February 10th, 2010.
Representative Dembro moves to adopt the -5 amendments to House Bill 3688. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the -5 amendments? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted. Representative Dembro.
Chair Gelser, I move House Bill 3688 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dembro moves House Bill 3688 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Roper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just want to implore that the Department of Ed make sure that this understanding of this bill gets out to all school districts, because I think there are a number of school districts that have had reimbursement policies in existence for a long time for kids that want to take extra courses outside, and then if they bring in the transcripts and they do all the stuff, they can be reimbursed for those classes. And I think you'll find that an awful lot of school districts do that. They need to know that they can no longer, if this bill passes, do that. That if they want to allow any kid to take any extra class out there, they're going to have to make an arrangement with the organization that allows them to do that.
Thank you very much. Representative Crump.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. First of all, I want to thank the department for bringing this issue forward, believe it or not. But the other part of that is this is obviously, as Representative Maurer has stated very clearly, it didn't take us long to start swinging around a different path than looking at where the grass is greener in another pasture on some of these issues. So I will be supporting this bill with the discussion that's been going on, but it definitely looks like it deserves some greater thought in the future also.
Thank you very much. Further discussion?
Sure, Madam Chair. You're looking at me expecting me to say something here.
You have that look.
It's that look of, gee, get that coin out again. I appreciate the comments from Representative Roebeling. I mean, it sounds like this is a common occurrence in public schools now, and I'm thinking this could really result in some really negative unintended consequences or maybe going beyond this. I'm not sure that there's, I haven't seen it yet, and I apologize. Maybe I can be schooled on this in between now and the floor vote, but I have not, I'm not sure what problem we're solving, really. It seems like it's all focusing in on one school, and the fact it, that's the appearance, and that there's something going on that is not liked there. Something just doesn't seem set right with me, and what Representative Comp was saying, it makes sense too. So for now, I'm not going to be in support of this bill, and I've just called down the gods of lobbying upon my head now, I'm sure, but that's the way it is. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Thatcher. Are there any further comments, any further discussion? Seeing none, Bonnie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Comp?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Roebeling?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
No.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer? Vice Chair Dembrough?
Aye.
Aye. Having received the majority of votes required for passage, the bill passes and moves to the floor. And I will close the work session on House Bill 3688. Carry on, Madam Chair. I'll carry this one. And I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3635. And would invite up Representative Edwards and Representative Harker. And Representative Edwards, would you prefer to have Dana give the description of the bill, or are you planning to do that as part of your testimony?
I'm planning to do it as part of the testimony.
All right. Very good. Is that okay with you, Dana?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Madam Chair, pleasure to be here. For the record, I'm David Edwards, State Representative from House District 30, which encompasses Greater Hillsborough, North Plains, and Williamsburg in Washington County. In conjunction with Stand for Children and the Oregon Business Alliance and a number of other supporting parties, I am pleased to introduce House Bill 3635, dubbed the Innovation Schools Bill. At the outset, I want to make clear that I view the introduction of this bill as the beginning of a conversation about how to best meet the needs of our student population. While modeled on legislation passed in several other states, most recently in Colorado, I hope to work this bill during the interim to ensure that it has a uniquely Oregon stamp and, if possible, broad support among the various stakeholders before reintroducing it in the next regular session. This afternoon, I plan to provide just a brief overview of the bill and then relinquish the microphone to others who can testify from their own philosophies and experiences. Simply put, the animating purpose of this measure is to improve student outcomes by facilitating greater school autonomy, and more specifically, by instituting a standardized process by which schools can implement creative, holistic, and evidence-based improvements. Simply put, it would allow one or more public schools to submit innovation school plans to the local school board as a means to best meet students' needs. These plans would allow more flexibility than usual at the building level in terms of academic offerings and operations. As has been demonstrated by exceptional districts in this state, this kind of flexibility often means a higher quality of instruction and maximally effective teaching practices. So the central aim of this bill is to support learning environments that encourage the development of uniquely effective learning environments. For the most part, current educational programs are geared toward the mythical average learner, with little regard for the significant range in learner variability, that is, their needs, interests, ability, achievement, style of learning, self-concept, among other things. Additionally, the need for parent, teacher, and administrator involvement in substantive educational efforts is paramount to effective school reform. Often, and I say this as a former Hillsborough High School site council member, the educational decision-making process leaves out those most affected by it. Innovation schools would empower teachers and administrators at the building level, giving them greater control over their learning environment. Briefly, here are the major components of the bill, and I'm not going to run through it section by section because it's not up for consideration for the floor. Innovation school plans, first of all, must be developed and approved by administrators and a majority of the teachers at the affected schools. The bill also stipulates a variety of methods for engaging parents in the process as well. There are a number of components that must be included in proposed innovation school plans, notably success measures, as well as change and risk management plans. Similar to current charter school policies, a description of any laws, rules, or policies that might be waived must be clearly stated in the proposed innovation plan. By the same token, a number of laws, rules, and policies cannot be waived, including compensation plans. This bill is not a means to institute merit pay, for instance. Schools are still charged with meeting the same state grade level standards currently in place. However, with this bill, they will be allowed more flexibility in meeting those standards. Local school boards will be the sole decision makers regarding acceptance or rejection of innovation school plans, and innovation plans will be in effect for a period of 3 years and may be renewed with school board approval. I will leave it to some subsequent speakers to address other details of the bill, but before I stand down, I would like to address a few misperceptions. First and foremost, this bill is not intended to diminish the ever-present need for secure and stable school funding. There is no doubt that our public schools need and deserve greater resources, but we have to face facts. Since its inception, we have not funded K-12 to the level recommended by the quality education model, and I submit that based on Monday's revenue forecast, we will not fulfill this commitment in the foreseeable future. While not giving in to this fiscal reality, I think it imperative we encourage innovation to ensure the greatest possible returns in the form of student achievement. So in the absence of a sudden surge in revenue, we should take every reasonable step to encourage innovation within our resource limits. And this bill presents one way to do just that. Second, some have asserted the bill implies a lack of effort on the part of teachers and administrators. From my standpoint, nothing could be further from the truth. My wife, for instance, is a teacher who has served as a director of special education, director of a pull-out reading program, and a classroom teacher. And you're going to hear shortly about some exceptional work done by dedicated teachers and administrators. But their efforts are exceptional in some cases because the process of effecting meaningful change is often more challenging than it should be. This bill is intended to provide a common framework to make that process easier and more predictable. Third, as a former talented and gifted student, at the risk of sounding immodest, I want to make it clear this legislation is not intended to minimize or somehow eliminate the program. Lastly, some have suggested the bill is unnecessary, that is more specifically that superintendents and or school site councils have the requisite authority to make the changes the bill promises. To this charge, I say all local situations are not equal in their willingness or ability to make such change, and further, that the lack of a standardized process for approving or rejecting innovation plans represents an unnecessary impediment to meaningful change. And this bill will bring a business-like discipline to innovation efforts statewide. As I've probably already exceeded my allotted time, let me conclude with this. I think that teachers and administrators need a clear path for enacting substantive education reform, and this proposal provides one such path.
Very much. Representative Harker.
Thank you, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. For the record, I am Representative Chris Harker from House District 34, which includes portions of Beaverton and unincorporated Washington County. I am happy to be a joint co-sponsor of this measure, of this bill, and I think the representative to my left here has done a very fine job of talking about some of the aspects of it that I was going to do. And so I will move right ahead into taking off the legislative hat and putting on the business owner's hat. All right, he has already made the case for we need more funding, but we can't do it right now. So what else can we do to help out
our students. So, as the business owner, I want to say that I run a software business. I'm the founder and owner of a software business in Beaverton. And we have 22 employees. And we are trying right now to hire more people. And these strong applicants are coming from around the country. There's some of that young creative class that are moving here. Well, we've got a really young, really creative class in K through 12 coming up in Oregon. And I want to ensure that we can train those folks, educate those folks to be strong candidates for the jobs that they're going for when they get out of high school, out of college, somewhere down the road. All right. And I think that this bill, as evidenced by what's going on in other parts of the country, is one way to help get them there. I also am here to deliver a letter which has been passed out to you by yours truly on behalf of the Software Association of Oregon, where my company is a member. And to just paraphrase what's in there, the SAO, on behalf of member companies and the thousands of entrepreneurs and employees who work on Oregon software-related businesses, has a keen interest in supporting and further improving Oregon's public schools. They have heard a lot of discussion about this, Representative Edwards, myself, some of the other people in the room here, and strongly endorse this position. Like me, they believe that a high-quality, broad-based education is critical for all of our students, regardless of their eventual careers. As software entrepreneurs, we are known, general perception is that we're heavy on emphasizing science and math. There are many among us who recognize that, yes, that's absolutely critical, but that's not all we're looking for, and that's not all we're trying to train our young people to be able to do. So I thank you very much for your consideration here, and can take questions if we like, or we can get the other folks up here and give their views.
Are there any questions for the good representative, Representative Dimbro?
Thank you. I just have a quick question. You know, one of the things that jumped out at me when I first was introduced to the bill was how this would sort of cohere with the contract parts of it would cohere with our collective bargaining laws, you know, in the state. And I'm wondering, have you gotten an opinion from legislative counsel of, you know, whether provisions of this law would be, you know, inconsistent with the public employee collective bargaining law?
I've not received, or Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Dimbro, we've not received an opinion from LC on that issue. Given that the bill's not up for consideration for a floor vote, we didn't go to that next step. But clearly we pursue that during the interim.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel? Representative Fletcher.
Thank you. This sounds intriguing to me, and I'm wondering if you could give me an example of what an innovative program might look like. What would it be? Do you have examples from other states? Are other states doing this? Have there been pilot projects around, you know, it sounds like some schools have already adopted some of the things you're proposing, and what keeps them from other school districts from doing the same thing? What would this enable them to do?
Sure. Chair Gelser, Representative Thatcher. This bill would simply establish a common framework for proposing innovation school plans. It does not recommend any particular program, but it would give schools additional leeway to make changes to curriculum, scheduling, staffing, etc. The bill does outline, again, a number of areas where they cannot waive the district-wide collective bargaining agreement, specifically compensation and a number of other areas. But let me give you an example of an impediment that could be resolved through this process. In some cases, districts bargained for a certain amount of prep time on a daily basis. But when some of the high schools moved to a block schedule, they couldn't accommodate the minimum amount of prep time, and they were shy by 8 minutes a day. As a consequence, there were some cases that has been reported to us that schools were forced to then increase class sizes to accommodate the minimum district-wide bargained prep time. And so from our standpoint, we think that those types of impediments should be able to be resolved in a kind of more uniform fashion, and again, address the, you know, best address the needs of our students.
Thank you. Okay.
thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelson. Now I have a question. Because in my mind, my experience has been annual innovation, depending on the makeup of your class and what were the needs of the class. And I can say that when I started with my job, we were small and we could flex quite easily. But the bigger we got, the more bureaucratic we became. And so what I'm hearing is the tension between the classroom, so to speak, where you're actually working with the children, where you need that flexibility, and then the administration, where you need that bureaucracy. So, and I guess in my mind, when you talked about an innovative school, I guess I was down over here with the teachers, and I'm thinking there's a lot of tension up here.
Chair Gelser, Representative Van Orman, the bill specifies that the Innovation School Plan must be approved by both the administration and a majority of the teachers at the affected schools. So it's designed to be a collaborative process to ensure that at least a majority of the staff at any one location are aligned in terms of the goals and proposed changes.
So follow-up?
Mm-hmm. Follow-up.
So are you envisioning then the whole system, or are you envisioning parts of the system?
Chair Gelser, Representative Van Orman, the bill applies to either individual schools or groups of schools that agree to a common set of changes.
Okay, so it would be, okay. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Oh, please, Representative Harper.
Very briefly, thank you, Madam Chair. My vision is to let them come up with the vision. We're not imposing this on them. The bill puts it in the hands of the school.
Now I have a follow-up.
Go.
So are you saying that we need to change some statutes then to allow that? They can't do this already?
Chair Gelser, Representative Van Orman, they are permitted to make the changes that are specified in the bill for the most part, but there's a lack of a standardized process for putting forward the plans.
Okay.
And so the purpose of the legislation is to provide a common framework for proposing the plans and to ensure transparency and the necessary follow-up on the part of the school board to ensure that the plans are actually working as proposed.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very much. Representative Roblin.
Just a quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this... But still, the school board has the final say. So, I mean, they could make a plan, and the school board didn't. So what you're saying earlier, that there are places where school districts have allowed it, what makes you think that this would change those school districts? The ones that have been allowing it will probably allow it. The ones that haven't will probably not be allowing it. So how is this bill going to change and give those teachers a better or that school a better opportunity?
Yeah. Representative Gelser, Chair Gelser, Representative Roblin. We believe that by establishing a common process that will encourage more schools to adopt or emulate the kind of advanced or innovative processes adopted by other districts. In other words, we want to make sure that those districts aren't succeeding by dint of some exceptional effort on their part. We want to make sure that everyone's on a level playing field in terms of their ability to put forward what they consider innovative plans to best meet their students' needs.
Thank you very much. Thank you both very much.
Can I throw one more in?
Yes, Representative Crump.
Thank you, because I wasn't going to. But as being an employee of a district, that in our meetings we used to comment, well, it'd be nice to construct the airplane on the ground someday instead of in the air. our district has a reputation for innovation and change. But the common denominator in all of our plans throughout our system, we were required to follow the federal mandates of ESEA and Title I for what is a school improvement plan. So there is a very concrete plan already very well established in numerous school districts that receive that federal funding. So would that be part of the analysis of this?
Chair Gelser, Representative Kahn, that's certainly part of the analysis, and we don't intend to allow districts to waive federal law in the sense of Title I.
Some of us have had to become more creative over the years.
Yeah, understood.
Innovative.
Thank you, committee. Thank you, good representatives. So next I would like to invite up, and just so that all of you know where we are in a sense of time, we've got four more panels over the course of the next 25 minutes. So our next is Dana Hepper, Ryan Deckert, and Mr. Bullock and Mr. Bremont. So maybe we can pull up a fourth chair there so we can all be there together. They probably won't be able to pull up a fourth chair. I think there's one on the side over there.
Oh, great. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I'll be really brief. I've emailed my written testimony to Dana Richardson, so I'm sure she'll send it all out to you, and you can take a look at it then. My name's Dana Hepper. I'm the Advocacy Director with Stand for Children. And I just really quickly want to reinforce what you already know, which is inside the school walls, teachers and principals that have the support and flexibility they need to they're the ones that are making the most difference for kids every day. The research backs that up. And while we're not asking you to vote on House Bill 3635 this year, we do really appreciate you taking the time to talk about this concept and start a discussion. In my testimony, I gave you just quick background on what happened in Colorado and one of the schools that falls under their innovation school law there and what they've been able to do. So I won't repeat that. That's there for you. It'll be in your email inbox, I'm sure. And I just wanted to make sure there's enough time for everyone else to speak, because I think what we're really excited to do today is lift up some of the great things that are happening in Oregon, and I want to defer my time to hear from those folks that are the administrators, teachers, and parents in those kind of schools here. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Representative Decker.
I am Ryan Deckert, the president of the Oregon Business Association. In the spirit of deferral to those who are on the ground, I will keep my comments very, very brief. A couple things. First, thanks to the sponsors for thinking about innovation in our school system. Secondly, thanks to the chair and to the committee for having a hearing on this bill. I think it's an important issue. Third, I was nowhere close, and I saw Representative Edwards as he was departing, close to being a tag student in my day, so I will put that disclaimer firmly out there. But with the strong statement that as we discussed this within our board and our education committee, we really came to a consensus around two issues. One is on the funding front, that we want to be front and center as a business community, supporting adequate and stable funding for our school system. Obviously, that's critical to the success of Oregon's economy. Secondly, we want to be equally front and center on the results side. And so whether it's innovative ideas like this, the race to the top application, or other important issues that this committee has taken up in the last year and I think hopefully plans to take up in the coming years, I think it's requisite for the business community to meet both tests and for our leadership to meet both tests of meeting the test on the funding front and ensuring their schools are adequately funded, and then asking equally tough questions about what kind of results we get and being open to, and I think the federal administration has laid out a strategy for that, and I think Chair Gelser, you and your committee are doing equally tough examination of our school system and looking at proposals similar to the one that Stand has brought forward today of how do we ensure that we're getting the results out of our school system that meet that test. Thank you for the time.
Thank you both very much.
Chair Gelser, committee, my name is John Bullock. I'm the principal of Redmond High School. I'm joined today by my friend and colleague, Michael Bremont, who's the principal of the Redmond Proficiency Academy, a charter school in our school district. We're here today to offer our support from Redmond for innovation in our public schools. We recognize how fortunate we've been in Redmond to be able to be one of the leaders in the proficiency-based movement of education. And we realize that that's happened in large part because we've had a superintendent that's been willing to support our crazy ideas that we've tried to implement to get our students to achieve. the reality is in Oregon public schools, as in public high schools across the country, is that we're not doing a good enough job for our students. We can do better. And to do that, we have to support innovation to make that happen. However, many schools don't have the luxury that we've had to have a superintendent that's been so supportive of that, of our innovation. And we know that the life cycle of superintendents and administrators is such that the school staffs often outlive those of us that are leading them. And so what we want to support is any endeavor that will allow us to formalize a process where innovation is not only honored, but it's encouraged and supported so that we can try and find a better way to ensure that our students can be successful. Mm-hmm. In particular, in Redmond, we created a freshman academy program that was it was entirely proficiency-based. And for those who aren't aware, we have about a 2,100-student high school. We're the largest high school east of the Cascade Mountains. And to take the proficiency movement full scale in a large high school became an impossible task because of all of the other factors that go into running a school. As a result, Michael and myself and some colleagues formed a charter school that would allow us to break down the barriers that get in the way of us trying to innovate for the students. And those include things like school hours and school times and teacher contact and the ways in which we go about training our teachers so that they're capable of delivering the instruction students need in order to achieve the success that we want. So I'm going to let Michael talk about what exactly the Redmond Proficiency Academy looks like so you have an idea about what sort of innovation is possible when we strip away barriers.
Thank you for the opportunity to come and share a little bit about what's going on in Redmond and within Redmond High School, as well as what we're doing within the Proficiency Academy. As Dr. Bullock mentioned a few minutes ago, I was at Redmond High School with him up until this year when we opened the Proficiency Academy, and we had a phenomenal superintendent who really advocated for our innovative ideas and our innovative thinking. But one of the issues came about with our inability in the current system to be able to flex our schedules, change teacher schedules, change student schedules within the system as it's currently designed. There's too many hoops, too many things to go through when you don't have a formalized process to be able to say, you know, within our system we can offer classes until 9 p.m. or we can offer students the ability to flex schedules so that they come to class in the morning and then maybe again in the afternoon so that they can work in between, because in a traditional high school system, that type of flexibility doesn't exist. And so what we did with the proficiency-based model was simply work with the school district to create an innovative approach that allows us to hire teachers. We actually hired teachers from Redmond High School who are familiar with the proficiency-based model, who are willing and interested in changing the way that they provide instruction and the hours that they provide instruction, and we now have a high school option within the Redmond School District where students can take classes starting at 7 a.m. and classes that conclude as late as 9 p.m. And we have students that choose to take classes a great majority of that day, and we have students who choose to only take evening classes, students who only take morning classes, many of whom have to work and do things to support their families. And so that really was a result of a superintendent, a school board, folks within the community who were supportive of that innovative idea. And like Dr. Bullock mentioned, we don't all have that opportunity. We don't all have the community support, the board support, the superintendent support to be able to make those types of innovations happen. And by this bill, it puts into effect some type of at least a formalized approach that allows districts to look at it and say, this is the approach, this is the model, this is the method that we're going to use to encourage innovation at our building levels.
And innovation in and of itself is not the key. It's the innovation that gets us to success. And for us, what that's meant is we, in the implementation of our proficiency-based program, for our freshmen, we went from about a dropout rate that was in the mid-teens for our freshmen to, over the past 2 years, we've not had a single freshman drop out of our school. And it's a result of the way we've restructured what we're trying to do for students and what we're providing them. And what I think is that can happen where we are, because we have the ability to innovate. But it needs to be able to happen everywhere, so that, and everyone needs to have that opportunity to innovate, because if there are practices at work, but it requires us to change the way we do business, then we need to change the way we do business so that our kids can be more successful. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
There are questions. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To our friends from Redmond, first of all, let me say that it's a pleasure to have you here. I've heard for a long time of how your proficiency-based academy has been really a kind of laboratory for the state. You know, you're taking a lot of chances and trying things out for us all. I'm wondering, you chose to go the charter school route. There's nothing, what would have prevented you from making the academy just a separate school within the Redmond School District? Presumably the superintendent was on board. I mean, I think this bill is also designed to address situations in which superintendent and principal may not be on the same page, and so they have to go to the State Board of Ed or something. But why go the charter school? Why not have just a regular school? Well, what were the impediments?
Ultimately, the flexibility in the charter school laws around the working conditions that our teachers were able to employ was a major factor, as well as the curriculum delivery systems that are available. So those flexibilities in the charter school model were available that were not necessarily accessible in the large scale model. And I think Michael can probably talk about that better than I can.
Well, that's really the key point, is that flexibility in the scheduling options in working with teachers and trying to develop a different style of curriculum when you're dealing with large groups of teachers that are part of unions that have policies and things in effect that impact the entire union, may not necessarily need to impact smaller groups or individual schools, but they still have to take those things into consideration. And so as we want to hire teachers that work different hours, we would have to be able to do it in the traditional system. We would have to go to the union and negotiate all that, bargain all of that, and really change some of those negotiated agreements, where by going the charter school route, we didn't have to do that. There's also some abilities in the charter school law that allow us to, some flexibility in the types of teachers that we hire and where we find those teachers. And so we can have a local doctor come in and teach anatomy and physiology, where in the high school system, in the traditional system, that local doctor is not qualified to teach anatomy and physiology, where in the charter school world, we can. So there's some ability to go outside and be creative in the way that we deliver instruction to students as well that isn't necessarily available in a traditional model.
The other structural impediment deals with the way in which grades are awarded, and that the basis of the proficiency model is that time is the variable in education, and a student that can learn the information in 6 weeks learns the same information that it may take another student 16 weeks. But if a term is 12 weeks long, the kid that understands it in 6, we've got to find something to do for them with them for 6 weeks. And the kid that learns it in 16 may have to repeat the course in some places because it takes them 4 additional weeks to understand it. And so to be able to change the schedule on the fly for students is what the charter school is able to do that we're unfortunately not able to do in the comprehensive high school system. So we've implemented proficiency in a different way, but true proficiency is not time dependent. It's dependent on the demonstration of skills and knowledge.
I could just follow up. So thank you. So the impediment that you're facing currently is that you would have to come up with work rules that would apply to all the teachers in the district, and have a majority of the teachers in the district agree to the changes, whereas that's obviously not an issue with the charter school, but presumably if we had a kind of innovation system, we wouldn't have to go the charter school route. You could just kind of carve out a special school and have separate work rules that would be approved by a majority of the teachers in that school. Is that how you see this playing out?
That was at least for me, that was the understanding of when I read the bill, that's the way it would work. And so you could create an innovative school within a district that didn't necessarily need to have work rules that applied to everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions for this panel?
Representative. Well, I was just going to remark on when you talk about the proficiency model in Head Start, we call it developmentally appropriate. And that's what it sounds like to me, is that we're talking about meeting the needs of every individual child.
Yeah, as a former elementary school principal, high schools have learned a lot from watching what happens teaching our younger children. Yeah, that's for sure.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have three more panels, and looking at the time, we can go a little bit past three. And so what I did, because I used to chair school board meetings that were very busy and full, the next panel we have is Rob Wagner, Tricia Smith, and Kathy Newman. And while they're coming forward, we'll allot about 7 minutes for each panel for the next two panels, and then we've got a smaller panel at the end. So we'll need to keep our questions fairly brief. Thank you. Please.
Hi, my name is Kathy Newman. Thank you for allowing us time to give input on House Bill 3635. I've worked for the Hillsborough School District for 20 years, the last 3 as the president of the Hillsborough Education Association, the 17 years before that as a teacher in grades 1 through 6. In that time, educators have experienced countless changes within education in the name of reform and innovation. And throughout it all, there's been discussion among the local school board, district administration, and the unions, especially when there was any question about how changes might impact workday working conditions or time to plan and collaborate. This bill would, in effect, eliminate any input from the legal bargaining agent for staff members. This not only potentially sets up a divisive process within the building and membership at large, but between the district and the union. The fact that this bill would have a simple majority in one building vote to rescind the contractual rights of all of the rest of the members within that building is not legal fair or helpful for workplace harmony. Most, if not all, bargaining agreements already have provisions for waiving items in the contract. This already exists. In fact, Hillsborough recently voted to provide a waiver for one high school so they could do some flexible scheduling that they felt would benefit students. And in fact, I think this is the third or fourth year they've applied for that waiver and received it. We have another high school within our district that also had applied in the past to receive waivers to flex their scheduling to better meet the needs of students as well as staff members, and they'd always received the waiver when they asked for it. In fact, Representative Edwards spoke about planning time and how just a few minutes basically circumvented the school from being able to implement that scheduling. We've not had that experience, and in fact, any time that you go to a block scheduling, the mathematics does say that you need more FTE or more staffing in order to make that work for the number of students taking the classes. It's not an issue with contracts. Another example is an elementary school that primarily served low socioeconomic students, a very high-risk population, and they actually asked for an extension to their day, to their work day, in order to offer more time with their students. This went through the waiver process. The union granted the waiver, and after a couple of years, the district actually went for that model for the rest of the schools. So you can see that we've been working with a balanced form of negotiations between innovation and the union and district school boards and so forth already. Another example, as the gentleman from Edwin was speaking about, The current contracts really don't preclude innovative programs that were being described. So, for example, in Hillsborough, we do have evening classes for students. We have a twilight program. We have a program set up for students that are working that they can literally drop in during times of the day to best meet their flexible schedules that they have for themselves. We have a number of programs for teen moms. We have all of those programs. They're all within the contract. They're very flexible, and none of them have had any issues speak of. In fact, if the district, the local school board, school sites, and unions are involved in the process, it actually may be possible to work out solutions that not only truly meet the needs of all the parties, but actually come out with a better plan. And that is the curriculum. The waiver does. I'm sorry.
Can I have you wrap up so we can give? Unfortunately, I didn't pick the number of people nor the time left.
Okay.
So I've got to keep everybody really short. So if you can wrap up in the next 10 seconds.
Okay.
And then we'll
if it's a matter of curriculum, that's not a contractual issue at all. That's strictly management right. So we don't have any input on the curriculum really anyway. So I appreciate the fact that our legislative body is wanting to provide avenues for schools and districts to try new practices. But I see the automatic waiver part of this bill to be problematic and not necessary in order to encourage innovation and best practices.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, Local 6732 of American Federation of Teachers. I'm here today in opposition to House Bill 3635, and to tell you, with all due respect to the sponsors, of course, that we believe, first of all, that this bill is about 20 years too late. The legislature took action 20 years ago to insist and require that innovation occur in school districts, regardless of whether or not we have resources. And as Representative Van Orman was speaking a moment ago about plans to meet the need of every child, that was the intention of our school reform law, was to assure that every child had his or her needs met by the educational system as that person goes through K-12. And I would believe, in spite of the billions of dollars that has not come to schools that we've needed in order to achieve those goals, and in spite of the many major pieces of legislation coming down, adding to the requirements of school districts from No Child Left Behind to many others, and the change in emphasis which comes about every 4 years in terms of what it is we should actually be paying attention to while we remain underfunded, that we, in fact, are innovative. If we were not innovative, I would suggest to you that our dropout rate would be much higher. We are $2 billion short of what we need to achieve the standards that you set. So if we are not innovative, how does anyone graduate from our programs? If we are not innovative, it is because we simply run out of day, we run out of money, we run out of people to be more innovative. I understand how difficult it is, how frustrating it is, because it is for us to want to do something to improve schools when we don't have a money machine manufacturing money downstairs. It's very frustrating for us as well. However, rearranging the deck chairs on the ship that's going down does not make the ship float. It just makes us feel better for a moment. House Bill 3635 does two things that don't exist in statute today. And those two things don't have anything to do with innovation. They require school boards to accept a plan from a group of teachers and a principal in a school if some very broad requirements have been met. And if you look at Section 7 of the bill and you think about those requirements as they're written, they're very broad. And I would suggest they're pretty easy to meet. So they don't get a choice if the plan is written properly. The other thing this bill does is it rolls back collective bargaining for every person who works in that school. It doesn't speak to the collective bargaining agreement of classified employees, but there certainly is one, and they will certainly be affected by the decisions made by a group of teachers.
Tricia, can I have you wrap up,
yes,
please? Thank you.
That hasn't been addressed in this bill. So you should ask yourself, what happens to the other 40% of the employees in that school? They're not part of the decision, but they are part of the impact of the decision. We would ask you to put this bill aside and help us find the funding so we can be innovative for every child.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the record, Rob Wagner, representing the American Federation of Teachers, Oregon. I'll be very brief. I know this is a preliminary informational hearing and that you've got more panels to attend to. Three brief points. First of all, although in five pages the bill mentions the word innovation or a derivative of 57 times, The American Federation of Teachers also support innovation. So I think there's other things we can do to have conversations. We have 1.4 million members across the country, and actually last year we just started an innovation fund. Our members have been nationwide partners in public school districts working on charter school reform, and in collective bargaining agreements from New York to New Haven across the country, we've been partners developing a system that provides for local buy-in around the issues of staff compensation and structuring educational options for students. The second point is that I do believe that the statute in Oregon is sufficient to provide for the sorts of innovations that you heard. The Redmond example is a good one. We actually represent charter school in Eugene, and we think that there is a robust system that provides for options for parents and teachers. You heard an example today. And this is actually really personal for me, too, because I have two sisters that teach at the Sunnyside Environmental School in Portland, and which is a national model for curriculum and for providing a certain type of educational options for students in that public school district. And they've been able to do it within the existing statutory framework with the agreement of the union and with management. The third point I wanted to mention is, and it's perhaps the biggest issue for me and potentially for our members too, is that I believe that this bill takes us off what we all need to be focusing on. And I was looking in my brain for an analogy, and what I thought of was this sort of bright, shiny ornament on a Christmas tree. And we can sit there and talk about innovation, but when you get in closer to the tree, what you find is that it's desiccated and it's dried out. And we're just this budget alone over $300 million short from the last biennium, what we need to be able to provide for educational services for children. So if people want to step forward and provide a quality education for students in this state, I would say bring a bucket, let's water the tree, let's work together. So that was my little creative analogy. So would say, let's work on this together. We look forward to those opportunities. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much. Burning question? Okay.
No.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Our next panel will be Alicia Hamilton.
Not me.
Dina Hallams and Tony Crawford. Please forgive me, but can you keep your testimony to about 2 to 3 minutes?
Most. Vice Chair Springer, Vice Chair Tumbrough, committee members, thank you for letting me speak today. I'm not sure where to begin because I don't really know how to my name is Alicia Hamilton.
Go ahead.
How to describe the introduction I received to the Sojourner Elementary School only 3 years ago. Imagine this, hip-hop music, a gym, 45 minutes of choreographed dance routines, 12-year-olds next to 6-year-olds concentrating on their next steps, and 150 children sing happy birthday to a handful of students. It's 8 a.m. Welcome to the beginning of a Sojourner student's stay. Do you know that juggling promotes math skills and learning the violin at age 5 helps build the portion of the brain relating to memory and attention? Or that building with recycled materials helps children discover how to problem solve and encourages innovation? These are but a few of the learning opportunities available to students at Sojourner. As a parent, I am immensely grateful for the handful of educators who had the innovation, the foresight, and fortitude to create a school that has never before existed in the state of Oregon. I'd like to thank the North Clackamas School District for taking the leap to back a school that innovates and expands on the norm. I'm here today to encourage you to allow other schools to follow a similar path. My daughter attends the Sojourner School merely by chance. We won the lottery for a select few available positions at the school. Wouldn't it be nice if you didn't have to roll the dice to have the opportunity to go to a school that asks more of the teachers, the parents, and the students? Wouldn't it be equitable to allow schools to determine how they can best allocate funds to serve the needs of their students? Imagine a school...
Alicia, if I could have you summarize that. It looks like you have some written testimony, and we're going to have that.
Yep. Sure. Imagine a school that not only meets or exceeds in standardized testing, but has proven to graduate leaders that excel in all their pursuits. The director of our school, Tricia George, closes every email with these words by Gandhi: be the change you wish to see in the world. And I hope that you allow the opportunity for our educators to do just that.
Thank you very much. My name is Dina Hallams. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm a parent of 3 children in the North Clackamas School District. I've also taught for 17 years at the middle school level in a high poverty setting in Reynolds School District, and I'm also chapter chair for North Clackamas Stanford Children and recently served on Oregon's design team for Race to the Top. The schools at which I teach serve children who largely come from homes of poverty. Their families struggle with housing and food security, language, cultural barriers, and generations of undereducation and limited unemployment
employment, limited employment opportunities. But the kids who sit in my classroom are full of just as much promise and potential as the generations of children who came from similar backgrounds in years past. A good public education is their ticket to a better future for themselves and their families. What has changed is the world they live in and a global economy that calls for more complex skills and an ability to adapt to a fast-changing landscape. In 2004, the team of teachers I work with was given the flexibility to better meet the needs of our students by being able to pull out small groups of students and individual kids. Students who needed extra support in core classes were given extra attention to bolster weak skills. Kids who were passionate about a particular topic were given the tools to push their excitement and achievement to the next level. The student who needed guidance in time management, study skills, or social skills had additional support. The students responded marvelously. Their grades improved, test scores shot up, and behavior problems diminished. After serving those kids for 2 years, our eighth graders were better prepared to meet the challenges of high school. That cohort of students are now seniors in high school, and I'm pleased to say that numerous examples of them who were underachieving seventh graders are now excellent seniors who are in AP classes and will soon be the first kids in their family to attend college. Their future for themselves and their family is forever changed. Sadly, in the fall of 2006, we learned that our district would no longer give our school the resources or flexibility to have those intervention due to a shift in district thinking and resources. We've lost this effective program that was locally designed and meeting the needs of our students. Unfortunately, one size does not fit all. As much as I would like to, I cannot solve all of the challenges my students bring through the front door. But educational research overwhelmingly demonstrates that the single most important factor in determining educational outcomes inside our schools is teacher effectiveness. Give us the flexibility to harness our expertise in best meeting the needs of our students who attend our school. What works in other schools may not work in mine. I support the goal of legislation like the Innovation Schools concept before you. It gives clear support, structure, and accountability to the belief that our principals, teachers, parents, and communities are our children's best resource and best hope in creating a bright future for themselves and for Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. And, Tony, do you have written testimony that you're going to be reading?
Well, I was just going to reference it and speak to it to Great. Try to be brief.
Thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Springer and members of the House Education Committee. My name is Tony Crawford. I'm a 30-year veteran teacher at Ackerman Middle School in Canby. Invite you to review the credentials that I offer in my introduction and the written testimony. Most notably, I am a member of Stand for Children and also the Oregon Education Association. I'm always happy to participate as a social studies teacher in the legislative process, but I regret that I'm here in front of you today. You see, one of the things that I have to share is that on two occasions I attempted to communicate with the leadership of Stand for Children what I considered to be my misgivings or my what I thought were the shortcomings of what eventually became House Bill 3635. I did discourage their forwarding this concept to the legislature, but unfortunately it was introduced, and here we are today. I wish to just address four concerns that I have with this particular bill. The first is an attempt to legislate from the top down what I believe needs to be grown from the ground up. What we're looking at here is trying to mandate something that I think needs to be developed with genuine relationships. In my own school district, we have an authentic, genuine, collaborative relationship between the local association and our district. It's manifested in our collective bargaining agreement. And, you know, what this has the potential of doing is undermining the hard work that we've put into this agreement. The second concern that I have is that this particular bill attempts to fix something that's not broken. If someone would like to talk about innovation, I invite you to come visit Ackerman Middle School any day you wish. Come visit my classroom. I'll tell you about the students at my school who, among other things, have offered peace treaty proposals between the Israelis and Palestinians. These peace treaty proposals were so well conceived that a representative of the federal government hand-delivered these proposals to Israeli and Palestinian leaders in Jerusalem. Okay, I swear I'm not making this up. Okay? You know, and so also wanted to suggest that we're working on a current idea that we think will help generate revenue for the state of Oregon. These are my students working on this project. We are proposing a Seven Wonders of Oregon similar to the recently adopted modern Seven Wonders of the World. And then around this theme, we developed a tourism campaign. And hopefully we could, you know, bring some you know, good things to our state. And if you want to talk about that one later, I'm glad to talk with you about it.
I would love to talk about that. However,
yes,
I'll give you 30 seconds.
And let me
just interrupt you briefly. I know that you're feeling rushed. I apologize for that. If you have additional testimony that you've not been able to share, email it to the committee assistant. It can get to us. But I really need you to wrap up in 30 seconds.
Okay, so that doesn't count as part of my 30 seconds?
No, you don't. No.
Thank you. Glad we can laugh. You know, one other thing that I just want to redirect our attention to is full support for the quality education model. You know, it's out there. This is what we need to be directing our attention to, not to be sidetracked with another attempt to, as we've already heard, you know, rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic. You know, the last point that I would like to make is that we want to insist on authentic work, and I think if you look at the language of this particular bill, you will find it already exists with the American Legislative Exchange Council webpage. As a teacher, you know, from time to time I have to check the authenticity of papers that are proposed. I invite this question. You know, if House Bill 3635 is such a great idea, why is it education stakeholders such as OEA, OSCA, COSA, and OSBA all lining up against it? Why is it that Stand for Children is apparently standing alone? Okay, it's a good question to raise. On a personal note, I believe the single most overused word in education today is innovation. Enough said.
Thank you very much
for the opportunity to address the committee.
Margaret Delaney, you're our last panel by yourself. And again, I want to reiterate that if you do have testimony that you've not had a chance to share with us, make sure the committee assistant gets it. But we're actually starting to have people peel off here, so if you could just keep it to a couple minutes, Margaret, I'd appreciate it.
I will be brief. My name is Margaret D. Lacey,
yes.
And I am here today.
Okay.
I'm a parent. I live in Portland. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association for Talented and Gifted to express our concern about House Bill 3635. I sent many of you letters. I won't reiterate everything in the letter. I would just like to say, correct a couple of things that were said here today. You heard it would not affect TAG services. In fact, any school of that writes an innovation plan, or any district can exempt itself from providing TAG services under this bill. That's why I'm here today. In its effect, this bill is very similar to bills that we have heard every session since as long as I can remember, about 20 years, that threaten the TAG mandate, and it's substantially similar to Senate Bill 441, which was not heard by you in the last session for a good reason, I believe. I would encourage you to continue to turn back attacks on the TAG mandate and many other of our state standards. I came here today at 1 o'clock. I heard all the testimony earlier today. I would just like to point out that under this bill, any school, group of schools or districts could write themselves an exemption, a waiver, from the bill you're just considering right here and now. The bills that you guys have passed, I don't always think are perfect. I've come back and asked you to change some of them, but they have gone through a pretty extensive hearings and legislative process, and I think that they're in the statute for good reason, most of them. I don't think that schools should have the blanket authority to exempt themselves from those rules. And in particular, there's no process. You were told earlier that there's a process for including parents. I don't see any process for including parents in this proposal, so that a school or group of teachers can write itself a plan and get it approved by the district with no parent input, as far as I can tell in this bill. I've heard a lot about innovation. We certainly support innovation. I sometimes ask you for changes, but I believe that we already have a process for creating waivers from inappropriate rules and laws and special circumstances, and I don't see why we should allow every group of school or district in the state to decide for themselves that they should be exempted. Thank you very much. It would prevent the Department of Ed from overseeing any of these issues. So I'll end there and answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And not seeing any questions, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3635.
Can I just make one point, Madam Chair? Thank you. Sorry, I'll just take a sec. Just, you know, I think in introducing this session, the Chair indicated that this was an issue that would have further discussion over the interim. And whether or not, I'd just like to say that whether or not what we look at in 2011 is this bill or some form of this bill, you know, I welcome the conversation around innovation. You know, I think as Tony said very correctly, change happens when you have trust and collaboration among parties. And so I think the extent to which we can bring people together and have a conversation around these issues, what's working now, what is not working, where there should be more flexibility, I think it's really going to be for everyone's good. And I would welcome that and love to be part of it.
May I respond?
Just very briefly, because I actually have to jet out the door. I let the chair know that. So I am going to gavel down in 5 seconds.
I would just say that we would like to be included in those discussions before the fact and not after the fact, as so often happens. We believe that we should be asked to participate in these decisions, and most of the time we are not.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And again, if there's any testimony that didn't make it to us, please get it to the committee administrator. And now I'm really going to close the public hearing on House Bill 35. And nothing else. We're adjourned.
Okay.